This is News from the Center, 1450 AM WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center. And always on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Mike Dubusky. At the center of the ongoing government shutdown, which is now in its third week, is a fight over health care benefits, with Democrats saying they want to reverse the cuts Republicans made to Medicaid benefits earlier this year. Until that happens, they won't vote for a short-term spending measure. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries spoke to ABC's This Week.
We will not support a partisan Republican spending bill, which is the bill that they continue to bring before the Senate and that emerged from the House. If that bill guts the health care of the American people.
Republicans say they might discuss the issue, but only after the government reopens. Israel has now confirmed it's behind the bevy of airstrikes that hit Gaza this weekend, with Hamas now saying they killed 18 Palestinians. Both sides are now accusing the other of violating the ceasefire. And in France, authorities are searching for a group of thieves who stole the country's crown jewels from the Louvre. This is ABC News. Relatives of Sonia Massey are preparing for the murder trial of a former police deputy. Cousin Sante Massey tells WLS-TV they expect thousands outside the courthouse in Peoria tomorrow.
In any other circumstance, this would be an open and shut case. Justice is justice, and we hope to secure justice regardless of who's involved.
36-year-old Sonia Massey died in July of 2024 due to a gunshot wound to the head, as now-fired Sangamon County Deputy Sheriff Sean Grayson yelled at her to put down a pot of boiling water. He has pled not guilty. The trial comes months after the family received a $10 million settlement. Philadelphia police now say the human remains that were found in a shallow grave on the grounds of an abandoned school are believed to be Kata Scott, who's been missing for the past 2 weeks. And the No Kings protests yesterday drew out about 7 million people, according to organizers. I'm Mike Dubusky, ABC News.
This is Robert Pilot of Native Roots Radio. On our show, we share stories from Turtle Island highlighting the people and issues shaping our communities. From protecting water to treaty rights and preserving languages and traditions, we cover it all. Hear voices like Arvina Martin of Emerge Wisconsin, Dr. Stately, Robert Lilligren, and more. Because Native issues are human issues, and human issues are Native issues.
Native Roots Radio, weeknights at 8 on your local Civic Media radio station.
Doctors Without Borders is delivering life-saving medical care where it's needed most in communities around the world. From bandaging war-wounded patients in Sudan to providing clean drinking water in Haiti, we're in more than 70 countries worldwide, bringing patients from sick to recovering, from emergency to aid, from crisis to care. This life-saving care is made possible by a global movement of supporters like you. Thank you.
107.7 WRCE, news from the center and home to mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
For Civic Media News, I'm Charlie Pittman. Wednesday was White Cane Safety Day. The day has been around for 60 years and recognizes people who are blind or have visual impairments. It's also a reminder to motorists to stop 10 feet away from people carrying a white cane.
In Wisconsin, motorists are required to stop no shorter than 10 feet from a pedestrian who is in the roadway, who is carrying a white cane or using a service animal.
Denise Jess is executive director of the Wisconsin Council of the Blind and Visually Impaired. She herself is blind and carries a foldable white cane. She says reminding drivers to take extra caution benefits all people.
We don't want drivers running over pedestrians, period. But vulnerable pedestrians who really can't see you coming need that that extra protection under the law.
Wisconsin's white cane law comes with a fine. And even though it's not against the law, Jess says it's also not helpful to honk.
But honking is confusing because we don't know if you're honking at us. You know, we have no way of visually verifying. Are you honking at us? Are you honking to give us information? Are you honking because you're irritated that you had to stop? There's no way to understand what that honk is. So while it's not statutory limited, it's just it's just confusing. We don't know how to interpret it.
Just says care and attention while on the road doesn't only benefit folks who are blind or low vision. It also benefits you as a driver.
It's so critical to our safety and your well-being. You know, if you were to hit one of us, it would change your life as well, and we wouldn't want that to happen.
October is also National Pedestrian Safety Month. For Civic Media News, I'm Sholly Pittman. More news anytime at civicmedia.us.
107.7 WRCE News from the Center.
And home to Matt and Air on Air weekday mornings from 9 to 11.
I'm meteorologist Brandon Bormans. Increasing sunshine throughout the day, but breezy and much colder. Highs only in the upper 50s. For tonight, mostly clear and crisp. Areas of frost possible late, lows in the mid-30s. An isolated shower can't be ruled out Monday afternoon. Highs in the mid-60s. Current temperature is 56 degrees.
Pete Schwaba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome Amy Gaither, director of a new show at the Festival Theater in St. Croix Falls. Then Eric and Adam from Ask Your Mother drop by to rock the studio. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwaba.
Weeknights from 6 till 8.
News from the Center, WRCE.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review, and my name is Jim Santel. I'm your host on this broadcast of Civic Media. This hour and next hour, talking, as always, through an ambitious but achievable agenda about the major issues in the rule of law, the administration of justice, and government operation in the United States of America, and occasionally beyond our borders as well. I appreciate, I value, I thank you for your decision to spend some time in discussion with me and my producer, Max, about these major issues. As always, the name of our broadcast taken from the Latin, also the legal term amicus, meaning friend. Amicus curiae, friend of the court. The notion that by providing facts and information, you can make decisions about policy issues, your own perspectives on issues. Here we are focusing on the things that have happened for greater understanding and appreciation of the world around us. Our lives, our livelihoods animated by an understanding, yes, indeed, in 2025 and probably beyond, about how the law works, how government works, how civics works. Again, an important part of our lives in 2025 in this important and challenging time in American history. Today, as always, inviting your questions, your inquiries, your comments, your observations, as always, here on Civic Media. That phone number is 855-752-4842. That's 855-752-4842. My producer also reminds me that you can drop a comment, a question, an inquiry into our discussion box here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Be a part of our engaged discussion about these major issues in the areas of law, government, and the administration of justice. This weekend's program, no exception, as a matter of fact, chock full, as always, with important information that has come from the major news stories of just this past week. Let me identify those for you and tell you a bit about the subject matters that we are going to be discussing this hour and next hour as well. We begin what is, from my perspective, the most significant news story in the area of rule of law this past week, and that is the likelihood that the United States Supreme Court at some point in the near future is going to find a major portion, the remaining significant enacting portion of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, either unconstitutional or in some way inapplicable in the early portion of this, the 21st century. We'll talk about a case that the Supreme Court had before it this past Wednesday called Louisiana versus Calais. That's the name of the case. You need to remember that. It will stand very likely in American history, along with other cases, which we will discuss. Calais, C-A-L-L-A-I-S, a major two-hour oral argument before the Supreme Court this past Wednesday, addressing, yes, on the surface, a very important issue for the state of Louisiana and other states around the country. That is how you go about drawing lines for congressional districts. Can you, in fact, use race as a means of accomplishing voting, ensuring that everyone of all races, of all immutable characteristics, has access to the polls? Can you do that? That's the fundamental question. Or as the challengers maintain, do the 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution prevent Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act from being implemented? Have we been wrong since 1965? Is that Section 2, which again, as we will discuss, is this major implementing portion of the law, this jewel of civil rights law coming from 1965, the pen of Lyndon Johnson, a bipartisan, cross-partisan decision by the United States Congress to enact the Voting Rights Act of 1965, already the subject of some major hits by the Supreme Court in cases called Shelby County and Brnovich. Will talk about that, give you some history on where the Supreme Court has been in the past, and then also analyze what the Supreme Court will likely do based upon significant portions of that oral argument of just this past week. Shelby County, Brnovich, and now probably Kelly. Calais, the third in these major Supreme Court cases, likely affecting dramatically, and that may be understating it dramatically, the future of the Voting Rights Act. And we'll talk not only about what the justices seem to be focusing on, which is once again time and the passage of history and what we're going to call, as they have called, durational limits, time limits on the applicability of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Has the time come in America to abandon the broad and ambitious goals of the Voting Rights Act and instead rely just on the 14th and 15th Amendments? No small things in and of themselves, but basically discard this notion under Section 2 that people of color and of other immutable characteristics, including language and other things prohibited by the Voting Rights Act, those kinds of things are anachronistic and should no longer be part of our legal analysis of voting and line drawing and gerrymandering and all those other things that are so incredibly important in 2025, especially important coming up in 2026, 2028, and for the years to come in our nation. We're going to hear, actually, from a part of the exchange between the attorney for those people who are advocating to retain Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, and you're going to hear from Justice Brett Kavanaugh, Justice Amy Coney Barrett, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, as they're in exchange, in communication with the attorney, testing the merits of this notion that maybe, just maybe, Section 2 should be time limited, that the durational time limit of the Voting Rights Act has come and maybe gone. And so we'll talk all about Louisiana versus Calais, sometimes called Robinson. There's a second case there. And that will occupy a major portion of the first hour of our broadcast this weekend on Amicus Law Review. Then we necessarily go back and talk, as we always seem to do, about the work of federal district court judges and federal appellate court judges as well. A major thesis of this broadcast has long been that it is the federal judges at those lower court levels who are the bastions of liberty, the bastions of supporting a republic, not pushing back on the president or other branches of government because they can, but because it is right to do so, because the Constitution contemplates that, and because Congress has passed laws that the judges of America, especially the federal judges, are obliged to implement and follow and enforce. We'll talk about the latest coming out of, yes, both Chicago and Portland, having to do with that continuing issue of the presence and maybe the activity, the involvement, the deployment into those cities, those major American cities, Chicago and Portland, of the National Guard. We'll tell you all about what the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals did just this past week in affirming a lower court judge who had said that the deployment of those National Guard forces could not be accomplished, even while they could remain in place. We'll talk about what the Seventh Circuit did to affirm that fundamental notion, some very important language about whether or not there is truly a rebellion afoot, whether there's insurrection, whether there's complete dismay and disarray and discord in the city of Chicago that would justify, under different circumstances, maybe the president's activity, the Seventh Circuit telling us unequivocally, decisively, that no such thing exists, and therefore the decision by the president to deploy and to attempt to place into the streets of Chicago members of the National Guard is unsupported by the law, unsupported by the Constitution. We'll also talk about what's going on in Portland. There, a judge named Karen Immergut, that we have spoken about before, she has not only re-upped her lower court order as the world is waiting for the Ninth Circuit to decide on the legitimacy, what she has said previously, much like Judge April Perry in Chicago, waiting on the Ninth Circuit sometime soon to issue its dispositive ruling, even though it has said already that it's not going to upset Judge Immergut's basic core ruling. Again, not having the deployment of National Guard into the city of Portland. We'll talk about those two significant updates in the rule of law and the likelihood, as promised by the administration already, to appeal those decisions coming out at least now from the Seventh Circuit, maybe from the Ninth Circuit, to where? To the United States Supreme Court. It may well be that on the docket of the Supreme Court, about 33 cases right now pending, at some point they may add these issues related to the authority of the president to deploy the National Guard in major American cities upon a finding that there is indeed this insurrection, that there is indeed so much calamity, that there is indeed a rebellion afoot in these cities that would justify that kind of action. That issue may in fact get to the Supreme Court even in this current term as the court begins to entertain issues and challenges before it. All of that coming up here on Amicus Law Review, as are other discussions about decisions of district court judges. We're going to go back to Chicago and talk about a decision made by Sarah Ellis. She is yet another district court judge. She is talking about how language is important. She has been trying to tamp down the level of animosity, the level of danger, the level of confrontation that has been happening in some areas in the streets of Chicago, based not upon the National Guard, but based upon ICE engagements with the people there. We'll talk there again about the extent to which she has said that we need no longer from ICE and other federal law enforcement to do things that not only animate, but aggravate the disarray there in the streets to some extent in Chicago. And then we're going to talk about some things that she said recently in which she is identifying ways in which the government, as we have seen in the past, is apparently not following her orders. We've seen that before. This is the constitutional crisis about which we have spoken at great length on this broadcast. From the pen, the words, the voice of District Court Judge Sarah Ellis, also in Northern Illinois, frustration about the failure of the United States government to follow her directives, telling those law enforcement folks to follow the rule of law, to follow her orders, ensuring that there not be these kinds of confrontations. And we'll discuss with all of you the focus, the meaning, the import of what Judge Sarah Ellis is saying these days. And then also another judge going back out to California, that having to do with a decision by another judge. We've heard from her before. Her name is Susan Ilston, Federal District Court Judge Susan Ilston, entering this order telling the administration in a completely unrelated or maybe somewhat related area that the president simply cannot fire somewhere around 4,100 federal workers using the present shutdown, the federal budget shutdown, as a premise, a predicate for doing just that, saying those things, while related in some distant way, one does not depend upon the other. And it is an exercise of inappropriate authority by the president to fire, as he has begun to do, some 4,100 workers. Susan Ilston saying, stop it, can't do it. and the judge there also entering an injunction against the government with respect to some union representatives, but also having an impact around the country on federal workers generally. Finally, necessarily talking about that other portion of the news, that is the indictment of John Bolton just this past week, the third in a series of indictments against people who have run afoul of the president. We'll talk about what the Bolton indictment says, why it is different from the Comey and James indictments, and what we can learn about it in connection with the rule of law in America in 2025. All of that coming up on Amicus, a law review.
This is News from the Center, WRCE.
Did the average S&P 500 CEOs earn in less than 2 days what their typical worker earned in all of 2023? Yes. In 2023, the average S&P 500 CEO earned about $17 million, or about $46,849 per day, compared to under $64,000 per year for the average worker. Median figures were similar. CEOs made $16.3 million, while median workers earned about $81,000, equivalent to less than 2 days of CEO pay. High CEO compensation remains a stark contrast to the modest worker earnings across major U.S. companies. I'm Trisha Young for Wisconsin Watch. Fact briefs are bite-sized fact checks of trending claims produced by Wisconsin Watch and GigaFact. Read more at wisconsinwatch.org.
I love playing sports, especially for my school. And that's because school sports are special. It's where it's safe to fail. It's where we're taught resilience, where our fear becomes confidence. It's where we learn to get back up after every fall. School sports are where 7.8 million students go from I can't to I can.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Seems like nobody in America agrees on much of anything these days.
But can we agree the federal government shouldn't tax people into poverty?
If you work full-time, you should be able to afford your basic needs. Don't you think? We're the Patriotic Millionaires.
We believe your full-time job should cover what it costs to live. We think your first $45,000 of income should be tax-free.
And multimillionaires?
We should pay more to fund your tax cut. Go to first45taxfree.com to learn more. A working-class tax cut paid for by millionaires. That's an idea we can all agree on.
I was stuck in a state of panic and endless rituals, so I made the call.
Mental health care works when you make the call. Visit mentalhealthcareworks.org. A message from the American Psychiatric Association Foundation.
As Wisconsin as a game of cribbage with good friends, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus, a law review. We are now talking once again about the Voting Rights Act of 1965, 60 years since President Lyndon Johnson signed off on that major civil rights legislation during the civil rights era in America. In the company of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., other major civil rights leaders, a law passed with bipartisan support back in 1965 to do a number of things related to ensuring that the franchise, that voting is permitted and is enforced and supported and given and otherwise protected for all people in America, including people of color and others of immutable characteristics. Premised upon the 14th and 15th Amendments of the Constitution, you know well what the 14th Amendment says. We talk about it a lot here, in part because of the president's invocation of some first language in the 14th Amendment, talking about the jurisdiction of the United States of America. That's the predicate for his birthright citizenship order. But there's another major, major portion of the 14th Amendment. It's the big portion, actually a number of sections of it, that ensure that the government will not abridge the privileges and immunities of citizens, nor deprivations of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor any denials to any person of equal protection of laws. That's all 14th Amendment language. Lots and lots of cases, lots and lots of lawsuits under that. We tend not to focus nearly as much on the 15th Amendment, ratified in 1870. The 15th Amendment says the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on behalf of race, color, or previous condition of servitude, talking plainly about slavery. All of those 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments passed in the wake of the Civil War. And so we also have then in 1965, the passage of this landmark United States federal statute that prohibits racial discrimination in voting. That's the fundamental way of thinking about it. It joins, of course, things like the Fair Housing Act, the Civil Rights Act, but it has been called the Voting Rights Act of 65, the crown jewel, and has had tremendous impacts in the 60 years of its existence, its invocation in and outside of courtrooms on ensuring that people have access to the polls. The statistics are clear, and the litigation has been important. By the end of 1965, 250,000 new black voters had been registered, one-third by federal examiners. By the end of 1966, only 4 out of 13 southern states had fewer than 50% of African Americans registered to vote. But after its enactment in 1965, the law immediately decreased racial discrimination voting in ways documented by historians, by statisticians, by civil rights folks. Its impact has been huge since 1965. This past week, before the United States Supreme Court, the specter that maybe, just maybe, a major portion of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 may no longer be accessible. Let's talk about what the law says, what is happening now in the United States Supreme Court. As I said, signed into law by President Johnson in August of 1965, amended 5 different times, supported over the years, endorsed over the years by the United States Supreme Court in a number of different cases, affirming the capacity of the Congress to do just this. A major case called South Carolina versus Katzenbach, 1966, holding that Congress does, in fact, have the power under the 14th and 15th Amendments, its enforcement powers, to enact this legislation. The Act, of course, contains numerous provisions, and that includes significantly a thing called Section 2. It's the general provision. It prohibits what? It prohibits state and local governments from imposing any rule, according to the statute, that results in the denial or abridgment of the right of any citizen to vote on account of race or color or membership in a language minority group. Other provisions of the law also prohibit literacy tests, other devices that were historically designed to prevent and to stop voting of racial minorities. The Act also contains some special provisions that apply only to certain jurisdictions, and that's where we get to two of the earlier Supreme Court cases that also had a dramatic impact upon the Voting Rights Act of 1965. You may recall these well. Shelby County versus Holder. Yes, that's the Holder, my former boss, the Attorney General of the United States of America in 2013. The United States Supreme Court struck down what's called a coverage formula as unconstitutional, basically finding that it was obsolete. The court did not strike down Section 5, but it did strike down Section 4. And what this was all about was the provision between Sections 4 and 5 that required that if certain jurisdictions that had a history of engaging in discrimination, if they did that kind of thing, they were required to go to the United States Department of Justice to get permission. It's called the pre-clearance procedure. In 2013, the United States Supreme Court strikes that down in Shelby County versus Holder, an amazingly written piece of jurisprudence at the pen of the Chief Justice saying, you know what, it's been long enough. And things have changed since 1965, and for that reason, we no longer need this particular coverage formula. And therefore, while the application of the process itself remains in place, the coverage formula itself is too broad, needs to be revised. Congress can do that to this day, hasn't remedied the Holder case involving Shelby County. That was strike one back in 2013, limiting the capacity of the Department of Justice to stop discriminatory actions, rules, regulations by state and local officials. There was a second case in 2021, a little bit more recently, called Brnovich. And in that case, the Supreme Court also strikes against the Voting Rights Act, substantially weakening Section 2, ruling that the totality of circumstances language of Section 2, that is where you examine everything in determining what is happening here, does not prohibit some voting rules that have disparate impact on groups. And again, a second strike there, Brnovich versus DNC. When we come back, I'll tell you more about those cases, and we'll tell you more about Louisiana versus Clay, which may be the third of these cases before the Supreme Court here on Amicus, a law review.
You're listening to News from the Center, WRCE.
You're listening to 107.7 WRCE, home for Matt Mayer on air, weekdays from 9 to 11 a.m.
ABC News, I'm Mike Dubusky. At the center of the ongoing government shutdown, which is now in its third week, is a fight over health care benefits, with Democrats saying they want to reverse the cuts Republicans made to Medicaid benefits earlier this year. Until that happens, they won't vote for a short-term spending measure. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries spoke to ABC's This Week.
We will not support a partisan Republican spending bill, which is the bill that they continue to bring before the Senate and that emerged from the House. If that bill guts the health care of the American people.
Republicans say they might discuss the issue, but only after the government reopens. Israel has now confirmed it's behind the bevy of airstrikes that hit Gaza this weekend, with Hamas now saying they killed 18 Palestinians. Both sides are now accusing the other of violating the ceasefire. And in France, authorities are searching for a group of thieves who stole the country's crown jewels from the Louvre. This is ABC News.
The Badgers lose again. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. College football, the Wisconsin Badgers lost at home to Ohio State 34-0 for a second week in a row. The Badgers were shut out. Last week, they lost to Iowa 37-0. Now, the last time the Badgers lost in back-to-back shutouts was 1977. Head coach Luke Fickell asked about fans at Camp Randall Stadium chanting "Fire Fickell" again.
I know this, that it's disappointing to our kids, but it's also can be motivating as well. And that's what we got to continue to find, is the ways to motivate us intrinsically that puts a better product out there, so we don't have to worry about things like that.
Badgers linebacker Darrell Peterson on dealing with the loss.
Oh, you learn from it. I mean, we just played number one team in the country. Now we played some slouches. Played a great team. And they played great on offense and defense today. You got to learn from it, and you got to keep going.
NFL, it's the Packers and the Cardinals at State Farm Stadium in Arizona. The Packers looking for their first road win this season. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
On your entertainment beat, I'm Pete Schwabba. If you're looking for a more efficient way to watch TV, this might be a deal for you. You can now bundle Apple TV with Peacock. Apple TV is already ad-free, but if you pair it with Peacock Premium Plus, which is Peacock's version of ad-free, it will cost you $19.99 a month. That's barely a savings from current prices, but if you go with the ad-supported Peacock, you can get both platforms for $14.99. Apple TV right now is currently $12.99, so that's not a bad deal, if you don't mind a few ads. It was pretty much a given Taylor Swift's new album, The Life of a Showgirl, was going to break records. According to Variety, Showgirl sold 4 million units in its first week. The old record was 3.5 million units for a week, which was previously held by Adele, according to Billboard. Swift also set a record, now having the most number one solo albums, breaking a tie she held with Jay-Z and Drake. She trails only the Beatles, who hold the record for all artists with 19 number one albums. For more showbiz fun, tune in to Nightlight with me, Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to 107.7 WRCE, home for Matt and Air on Air, weekdays from 9 to 11 a.m.
I'm meteorologist Brandon Bormans. Increasing sunshine throughout the day, but breezy and much colder. Highs only in the upper 50s. For tonight, mostly clear and crisp. Areas of frost possible late, lows in the mid-30s. An isolated shower can't be ruled out Monday afternoon. Highs in the mid-60s. Current temperature is 56 degrees.
As veterans, we're no strangers to helping others.
That's what we were taught, service before self.
But we do have one question for the veterans listening.
When is the last time you reached out for help?
If you or someone you know needs resources, whether it's for stress, finances, employment, or mental health, don't wait. Reach out.
Find more information at va.gov/reach. That's va.gov/reach.
Brought to you by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs and the Ad Council.
Matt Nair on air.
He is the executive director of Back 40 Action. Will Westmoreland is here. So, Will, we can't sell our soybeans. There's no market for that. But Brooke Rollins, Secretary of Agriculture, says it's all great. What are you hearing from fellow farmers?
Well, Jane, we are the world's leader in one Department of Agriculture now that Donald Trump is president and Brooke Rollins is Secretary of Agriculture, and that's word salad.
Matt Nair on air, weekday mornings 9 to 11 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody. Join us next time after a very disconcerting and busy news and sports weekend. We will sit down and discuss it all with our friend and colleague of Matt Nair on Air, Jay and Matt Nair. Join us.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays 2 to 4.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. We are talking in this segment and next segment all about this major oral argument before the United States Supreme Court this past Wednesday in a case called Calais, C-A-L-L-A-I-S, sometimes called Robinson, coming out of Louisiana. In the wake in previous years of the Supreme Court striking down major provisions of the Voting Rights Act, Section 4 in Shelby County, the preclearance provision, Section 2 limited dramatically in terms of its impact to change bad voting rules and processes. That case is Brnovich. Now we have Calais. And will this be the third strike by the Supreme Court to bring the Voting Rights Act to its knees, or at least close to that? Where do we get this case from? Does come out of Louisiana, as we have talked about before. Comes in the wake of the 2020 census, of course, as we did here in Wisconsin. Louisiana's legislature adopts a congressional map that included only one majority black district out of six in the state, even though about a third of the state's population is black. So what happens is a group of black voters go into federal court. They invoke Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, saying our vote is being diluted, it's being abridged. And in particular, this particular decision about drawing the lines in this way without two majority black districts is an abridgment of the right to vote based on race because of the dilution of the votes of those black residents. Federal District Court agrees, throws out that map, and orders that a second map with a second majority black district be put in place. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals upholds that ruling, orders Louisiana to draw that new map by January of 2024 or face the prospect of a trial. The legislature does that. And in response, the legislature then has in 2024 a new set of maps in Louisiana with two majority black districts. The adoption of what's called SB 8, that's the legislation that does that, leads to a lawsuit. And this lawsuit contesting the creation of those two majority black districts is brought by a group of voters that are self-described as non-African-American voters. They contend that this new map is an unconstitutional racial gerrymander. Following all this, that it sorted voters based primarily on their race, and that that is in violation of the 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution. Basically, that the Constitution provisions about voting supersede Section 2, are in conflict with it, and therefore, the directions of the federal court below to create the second majority black district in Louisiana cannot stand. And most importantly, maybe also, that Section 2 can't stand because it's in violation of the Constitution. And that brings us to the oral argument of this past Wednesday. What you're going to hear now in just a moment or so is a discussion discussion among Janai Nelson, who's the NAACP Legal Defense Fund lawyer, who's arguing in favor of Section 2. You're also going to hear some questions of her by Associate Justices Brett Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, and then also Ketanji Brown Jackson. Listen to what Justice Kavanaugh says about time limits, durational limits, and whether or not it has come time for the Voting Rights Act Section 2 to be abandoned. Listen to what Ketanji Brown Jackson says in the other extreme about what Section 2 is meant to do, not a remedy in and of itself, but a tool. This happening this past Wednesday, hear now a portion of the oral argument in Louisiana versus Calais on the future of the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
If I may address the durational limit question, which came up, I'd like to talk about the fact that Section 2 is self-limiting. I know that there is a general concern about the indefinite use of race, and there are several reasons why that concern should be allayed. First and foremost, there is no precedent to suggest that a statute must dissolve on its own simply because it may require a race remedy. And as I've mentioned, race is not required by Section 2, but it can be used if that is necessary to address the Section 2 violation. In addition, the non-discrimination element of the 15th Amendment is a permanent right, and so should be the protection that Section 2 affords. And finally, this is a significant concern where Congress was very clear that it did not want to include a durational limit. Congress included a durational limit in Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. It created a mechanism for reauthorization. It decidedly did not do that in Section 2.
The issue, as you know, is that this Court's cases, in a variety of contexts, have said that race-based remedies are permissible for a period of time, sometimes for a long period of time, decades in some cases, but that they should not be indefinite and should have an endpoint. And what exactly do you think the endpoint should be, or how would we know for the intentional use of race to create districts?
Well, Justice Kavanaugh, you raised a very important distinction, and that's between remedies and the statute. So a race-based remedy can and should and usually does have a time limit and a durational limit. Section 2 court-ordered remedies have a time limit. And so that is something that is grounded in our case law. What is not grounded in case law is the idea that an entire statute should somehow dissolve simply because race may be an element of the remedy. So, for example, this case has affirmed Title VII. It has affirmed Section 1982, the Family Medical Leave Act, and also Section 4E of the Voting Rights Act in Katzenbach versus Morgan, and never has it suggested that any of those statutes should dissolve in and of themselves
as opposed to the remedy. I'm sorry to interrupt. I don't think it's the statute. It's the particular application of the statute that entails the intentional, deliberate use of race to sort people into different districts. That particular aspect, I'm guessing, I'm asking what you think the time limit on that should be, or there really shouldn't be a time limit. I think you might be saying there shouldn't be a time limit unless Congress chooses one.
I am saying that. I'm saying there should not be a time limit, but I also think it's critical to emphasize that Section 2 does not require a race-based remedy in all circumstances.
Is that because... I just wanted to follow up on Justice Kavanaugh's question. What if this is an exercise of Congress's enforcement power? If we're looking at the city of Burney test and we're saying it has to be congruent and proportional, would that affect your answer to Justice Kavanaugh's question, that if it's going above and beyond what the 15th Amendment requires of its own force, but Congress has actually chosen the Voting Rights Act as a remedy, does that affect the question of whether it can go on indefinitely or not, that at some point it becomes not congruent and proportional?
No, I don't think it does. First, Bernie should not apply to Section 2. Assuming that it does, as you know, in Bernie, this Court held up the Voting Rights Act as the paradigmatic example of congruence and proportionality. The fact that the Voting Rights Act at times may require a race-based remedy does not change the fact that Congress, with its enlarged powers as defined by Ex parte Virginia and the line of cases forward, can address conduct that is beyond what the 15th Amendment addresses. It doesn't need to simply parrot the 15th Amendment. It can address conduct that is even considered constitutional in order to ensure that race discrimination in voting does not go undetected, uncorrected, or undeterred, in the words of the Senate report supporting
the 1982 amendments. So, Ms. Nelson, I guess I wonder if it would be helpful, at least as I'm thinking about it, because I think this is a very important question. To understand, I think, that you're saying that Section 2 is not a remedy in and of itself. It is the mechanism by which the law determines whether a remedy is necessary.
That's absolutely correct.
So it's a law that is just encouraging or requiring a check-in. It's like a tool. It's like a tape measure that we're looking as to whether or not certain circumstances exist, and those circumstances that Congress is worried about is unequal access to electoral opportunity. And Section 2 tells you we have to look for those circumstances, and then the court says, yep, they exist in this situation under Section 2, and so now a remedy is required. And in our case law, we then say, okay, state, it's up to you to figure out what that remedy will be, and maybe that remedy involves race consciousness, maybe it doesn't, whatever. But Section 2 itself is just the measure by which we determine that a remedy is required.
That's absolutely correct.
And so that's why it doesn't need a time limit, because it's not doing any work other than just pointing us to the direction of where we might need to do something.
That's right. And its usage becomes less and less as we see racially polarized voting and residential segregation decreasing. The Katz amicus brief in this case shows that in the past decade, Section 2 cases have decreased by 50%.
Because the plaintiffs can't make the showing.
I mean,
it's a pretty significant showing to establish that unequal opportunity of electoral processes is happening in a situation.
That's correct. Jingles is an exacting test. It is data obsessive. It brings in experts and many other forms of evidence to establish a racial violation. There are many cases where the plaintiffs fail in bringing the Jingles 1 precondition or Jingles 2 or Jingles 3 before they even get to the totality of
the circumstances. So if we're talking about a time limit, you would say maybe it's with respect to the remedy that is used to respond to the problem that we've identified under Section 2. But the Section 2 tape measure itself doesn't need a life cycle. It's just,
no.
Yeah.
That's correct. I mean, the 15th Amendment is permanently enshrined in our Constitution, and Section 2 is there to effectuate that prohibition of race discrimination on voting and does not require a time limit.
Thank you.
That was the United States Supreme Court. About 7 minutes of oral argument fairly early on in a 2-hour oral argument this past Wednesday on the future of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 in America in 2025 and beyond. Who you heard there principally once again is Janae Nelson. She is the lawyer for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. You heard Brett Kavanaugh significantly define a portion of the argument, actually overcame many of the other arguments during the course of the discussion. He said, this court's cases in a variety of contexts have said that race-based remedies are permissible for a long period of time, but they should not be indefinite. That's Brett Kavanaugh speaking, and asks Ms. Nelson, what exactly do you think the endpoint should be, or how would we know for the intentional use of race to create districts? How should that end? When should that happen? You had Amy Coney Barrett briefly interceding there as well to ask about some issues. And then you had this at the opposite end of the spectrum, this exchange between Ketanji Brown Jackson and Ms. Nelson, again, the attorney for those who want to support Section 2, want to keep those two districts in Louisiana. Ketanji Brown Jackson articulating this fundamental notion that Section 2 does not have to go away, that it is a mechanism, it is a remedy, it's a bridge, if you will, it's a tool to accomplish something, but the law itself does not need to go away and should not go away because not only do you have Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act enacted pursuant to the 15th Amendment, but the 15th Amendment itself prescribes equal rights under the law in the voting setting. And so we have in this oral argument, in that 7-minute period, a codification of what the Supreme Court is wrestling with right now. And when we come back, some final comments about this oral argument in Louisiana versus Calais, where the Supreme Court may go and what it means for the future of voting in 2020.
Reach, engage, grow with Civic Media. Log on civicmedia.us/advertise.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. The Wisconsin Department of Transportation just announced the official start date for one of its biggest ever construction projects, the I-94 East-West Project, which will reconstruct and widen a 3.5-mile stretch of interstate highway in the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County. This is a massive project with an estimated cost of more than $1.7 billion. And with this official start date announced also came estimates for how long this will take. Construction is expected to last until 2030. At the recombobulation area, this project is something we've covered extensively, including with an award-winning 4-part series called Expanding the Divide. It might be worth revisiting that series and considering how unnecessary and expensive an extra lane is and how in southeastern Wisconsin, we're going to be dealing with construction and delays for the next 8 years in order to shave a few minutes off suburban commute times while the city streets and city problems go ignored once again.
Find all of Dan's work at the recombobulation area.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. The conservative majority of the U.S. Supreme Court appeared to agree October 15th with arguments that the Voting Rights Act Section 2's majority-minority voting districts conflicted with the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. A decision is expected next year. Chief Justice John Roberts signaled that the court's 2023 Milligan precedent, a very similar case, may not apply to Louisiana versus Calais. Justice Kagan later pointed out that the court rejected several similar arguments by the state of Alabama defending its discrimination. Louisiana argued that the court-mandated majority-minority districts, giving minority voters an equal chance to elect the candidate of their choice, puts the state in a position to discriminate against other voters. Justices Kavanaugh and Coney Barrett both voiced support for an endpoint to sunset such opportunity districts. The court's Jingles test, used to determine if a group qualifies for such a district, was also questioned by the conservative justices. In her opening argument, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund's Janae Nelson said that should the court strike down Section 2, it would be, quote, a staggering reversal of precedent that would throw maps across the country into chaos. There are 148 VRA majority-minority districts in 28 states, according to Ballotpedia. We've linked a transcript of the arguments at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
The Todd Alba Show.
The incomparable Jane Mattner.
I have been in radio for 44 years.
It's incredible.
I wanted to be an actress originally. Radio to me was mind theater. Mm-hmm. I could be anybody.
Yeah.
And people could imagine it. It's like reading a book mm-hmm. instead of the movie. Is your mind gets to fill in lots of details. And I think that's part of the genuine experience of radio.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays 2 to 4 on your local Civic Media radio station. And on the app. As Wisconsin is dropping a line in your favorite fishing spot, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus, a law review as always. In the remainder of this hour and into next hour, taking your comments, your questions. I suspect they're out there in the wake of this very important, historically defining oral argument of this past Wednesday before the United States Supreme Court. Our number here at Civic Media, 855-752-4842. What did you hear? What did you hear in that brief 7-minute exchange among the the attorney advocating, yes, on behalf of those people who believe in the future of the Voting Rights Act in Section 2. Janae Nelson, NAACP, arguing that Section 2 has a mechanism to pursue not only problems in connection with voting, but also does not need to be and should not be discarded in the midst of this lawsuit coming out of Louisiana. Louisiana, again, having drawn two majority black districts, being challenged by this group that maintains that that decision, race-based, is in violation of the 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution that talks about equality, and maintaining that the Voting Rights Act, Section 2, is inconsistent with that, and therefore the Voting Rights Act needs to be stricken, and Section 2 in particular needs to be stricken from the laws of our nation. What did you hear during the course of that 7-minute exchange? You heard very likely how this case is going to be decided perhaps soon, certainly no later than June of next year, which we will talk about as well. On the one side, we heard once again, as we have heard before, this reference to the notion that we no longer need to be focused, as we had to in 1965, on race. Recall well that in the case of Shelby County versus Holder, that was 2013, the Chief Justice himself said, you know, all of this is based on 40-year-old facts that have no logical relationship to the present. The time has moved on, passage of chronology here, and therefore we no longer need these kinds of remedies. We no longer need these kinds of formulas to address racial discrimination in voting. And you heard Brett Kavanaugh articulate that, admittedly, in a very diplomatic way when he said that these statutes should not be indefinite. They have to have an endpoint, he said. What is the endpoint? How do we know when we've gotten there? That is going to be one of the central features of whatever the Supreme Court decides here with respect to Section 2. At the other extreme, you have plainly Ketanji Brown Jackson and presumably Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor saying just the opposite, that indeed Section 2 is a means to an end. It is the mechanism. It's a tool. It's doing the work, if you will, of determining whether there is discrimination. And if so, then the courts need to fashion the remedy. It's the remedy itself that may at some point go out of style, out of fashion, out of time. But this notion of establishing a time limit, this notion of establishing a time period by which the Voting Rights Act in its very nature is now obsolete, that it has come to that point in American history that we no longer need this kind of protection. Ketanji Brown Jackson, obviously joined in by Janae Nelson, arguing for the future of the Voting Rights Act, saying, no, 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 no. We have many statutes out there that can be invoked in appropriate circumstances, not every day, not every week, not every year, but they're there to remedy situations. She talked about the Family Medical Leave Act. She talked about other employment discrimination statutes. All of those available in the circumstance where there is discrimination of some kind and then can be invoked. Doesn't mean you throw out the statute itself. That's what Ketanji Brown Jackson was arguing about and pushing back on this notion of, and here's the concept, temporal or durational limits, that somehow the Supreme Court is going to say that Section 2 has outlived its usefulness. A durational limit should now be imposed, a temporal limit, a deadline for its removal. Those are the two competing views. And frankly, throughout the remainder of the two-hour oral argument on Wednesday, that animated much of the discussion. And here's the rub. Here's the takeaway from all of this, and that is it appeared, difficult to say with certainty, it appeared that a majority of the Supreme Court on Wednesday was inclined to side with Justice Kavanaugh and presumably also the Chief Justice in finding that indeed durational limits require that something be pushed back. Maybe rescinded entirely, Section 2, maybe limited in some defining, limiting way. We don't know. But it appears that the minority, the three justices, Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan and Ketanji Brown Jackson, will be in the minority arguing for the future of the Voting Rights Act whenever this case is decided. And that brings me to the last point, which is the Supreme Court now has this under advisement. presumably engaging at some of its decision conferences about what to do on this matter, could issue the opinion on Monday, could issue the opinion in 4 weeks from Monday, in 4 months from Monday. We assume often that in these major cases, they will wait until June. They could. But the other portion of this case is so important is that it could also have a dramatic impact upon the 2026 elections, plural, including the November midterms. And if indeed the Supreme Court waits until June to decide, maybe to amend, to discard a major portion of the Voting Rights Act, doesn't give states a lot of time to draw new lines, which they could do absent the prohibitions of the Voting Rights Act. If race is no longer a consideration, states, as they have done in the recent past, even recently, will move quickly to redraw lines for political purposes, maybe for racial purposes as well, depending upon how they are described, will be given the latitude to do that, but have to have those in place in time for people, candidates, to know what the lines look like in anticipation of November of 2026. Not a lot of time between June and November. Has to happen very quickly, which leads me to the possibility that this case may well be decided before June, if the Supreme Court does indeed want to give states around the nation that capacity to change the future of voting, change the future of America. When we come back, we're going to go back to other federal courts, including district courts in the Midwest, out west, as Amicus, a Law Review, continues.
This is News from the Center, 1450 AM WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center, and always on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Mike Dubusky. Congressional leaders are now weighing in on the government shutdown, which is now nearly 3 weeks old.
Congressional leaders continue to dig in. There's no end in sight to the government shutdown. Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries told ABC's this week that Republicans
care more about George Santos and freeing him than they do about providing health care to everyday Americans.
Speaker Mike Johnson said he believes in redemption when asked about Santos. He mocked Saturday's No Kings protests.
If President Trump was a king, the government would be open right now.
Brian Clark, ABC News.
Israel now says two of its soldiers were killed in combat in southern Gaza today. Meanwhile, Hamas says 18 Palestinians were killed in a wave of Israeli airstrikes over the weekend, with both sides now saying the other has violated the ceasefire agreement. And four thieves are still at large after stealing the crown jewels of France from the Louvre Museum in Paris today. This is ABC News.